Thank you for joining us today, and welcome to Talk About with Rez and Andy, live every Monday at 3 p.m. I'm your host, Linda Rez, and I'm here with my co-host and great friend, Janie Andy Anderson. Welcome to Talk About with Rez and Andy. Hope you're having a great day wherever you're at. I'm your host, Linda Rez, and I'm here with my co-host and good friend, Janie Andy Anderson.
Linda. Congratulations.
Yeah.
1 year anniversary.
Yes, we've been doing Talk About with Rez and Andy for a year on Blog Talk Radio, and that's what we're going to celebrate
it's
today.
It's a big one.
Yeah, where's all the party stuff?
Who's taking us out to dinner?
That's right. Where's the prize?
Where's the party?
It's been a fun year. I have a list of all of our shows I'm going to hand you right there just so you can get refreshed about it. But first of all, let's talk about our week because that's what we do. We just kind of open up. There's been a lot going on. You know, on TV, you've got the NCAA championship going on. And all these shows are starting back up, like Mad Men and The Outlander. The Vikings. I love The Vikings, and they've been up going again for about a week. And then what else? Oh, Game of Thrones is going to be starting up in 2 weeks. So lots of TV.
I need
and
to
I
move
have been watching
in with
it
you.
All.
I do. I am missing the boat.
Yeah, there's been a lot going on. We're going to talk about that. And then we're going to talk about some of these shows that we've done this last year. I can't believe you. Look at this list.
We have had great shows.
A lot of different kinds of guests, from serious conversations to comedians, really funny conversations, Jeff Foxworthy and Paula Poundstone, musicians, authors, just kind of all over the board.
Very diverse.
Yeah, and we try to do these shows live every Monday at 3 p.m. We do welcome you to call in and say hello and tell us where you're at. The call-in number for you is 909-202-8606, and we love company, so the lines are open. You can call in at any time. And if you do call in, you'll just go into a queue, and as soon as we have an opening, we'll bring you in. And you'll be able to hear the show while you're in there. So, first of all, what's been going on this weekend with you?
Well,
I've only watched TV.
I talked to you last weekend, and of course, you have such a busy life that I think our last get-together, I told Linda I might have to lie, but I think I'm okay. Thank goodness.
You must have done
something. I should say thank God for Easter.
Yeah. Everybody has something to do on Easter, right? So what happened on Easter?
Well, I want to hear about you, but, you know, I had a great weekend. I went to a wonderful sunrise service, and it was cold outside, but it was a beautiful service. And then, of course, got the family together at my niece's, and it was wonderful. I mean, it's a day of celebration, and just thoroughly enjoyed it. What about you, Linda? You had big group of people.
I was surprised on Sunday the amount of stores that were closed, and I'm very happy that they were.
I think it's great.
Because, you know,
we
did a special on, you know, closing at Thanksgiving. Easter is another one of those, and I've heard people complain that there are stores open, although I had to go out to get some things that day, and they were all closed, except Home Depot, I noticed, was open. But Target, I had to go to a feed store, Costco, you know, all those places were closed.
I'm glad to see that.
So if you forgot something for your dinner, you were out of luck.
You need
to
plan.
Yeah, I was happy about that,
you
too.
You need to plan.
What did I do? Oh, gosh.
You had
well, you
a
know,
group in.
Last week, we just played a show because we were gone. And, well, you know, we were here, but it would have been such a busy weekend. I had gone to see my son graduate from boot camp. He's in Air Force. He's in the Air Force boot camp.
Most
and
wonderful
graduated
kid
now.
In the world.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And so all of them were. I was so surprised. He was down in San Antonio. And the young men and women serving our country are wow. I mean, I thought my son was great.
They're the best.
There was not a one in that group that wasn't just as equal to my son. In fact, he was probably in the medium range, you know, of greatness. they were all fantastic human beings. The kind that opened the door and you know, they talk respectfully. And it really made me think. And they were from all different walks of life. And like I said, men and women. Black Americans, Mexican Americans. There are three different groups that three different people who got their citizenship. They were from three different countries because they have a thing that you can, if you get through boot camp and you're going to serve our country, that's a path to citizenship. So that was really cool. And it was just, you know, it's just like the best of what the United States has to offer in young people.
It's too bad everybody doesn't have a stint in the service.
Yes.
I mean, they learn discipline.
You would probably
dedication.
Solve half
it would
of
solve
our problems.
A lot of problems.
Our crime problems, our drug problems. Our
a lot of problems.
I mean, my son was a pretty great kid before he went in, but it changed him even more. You know, just it just made him that much more that much more serious about everything, I guess, and wanting to contribute to this country, and having a sense of you know, national duty, and you know, and just doing something for other people other than himself. So yeah, I think everybody should.
There should be nothing but pride. You should just, I mean, Coleman is a great, great kid. We did, and I think it was during, of course, the racing, the horse racing season last year. We did an interview with Billy Vance, who is a local horse jockey, and we had talked to him about how good he was. I mean, no matter what kind of weather, he was there, and he was always early. I mean, he'd be working horses at 5:36 in the morning, no matter what. And we had asked him, what do you attribute your dedication and your work ethic? And he said it was from serving in the service.
Yeah.
He learned right.
Well, you hit it right on the nail on the head. I think that everyone should be required to do some national service. And it's not so much trying to get something done for free or anything. It's just that, I mean, they wouldn't be doing it for free anyway. They get paid to do this. But just to give them a sense of national, and just a sense of purpose
pride
in their own life. Because mm-hmm. these young men, when they're that age, they don't know what they want to do a lot of times. And, you know, it's before you get married and have children, and you're kind of in that in-between space. So anyway, I was so impressed. I can't even tell you how impressed I was with the quality of the families who were there to support the young men and women. That it was packed. They had stadiums surrounding the parade field, and you know, like a football stadium practically. And it was packed with families. I think my son in my son's unit, he said there were only three young men that didn't have someone, you know, from his unit have family coming because they just couldn't make it.
Really?
But they were all adopted by other families who were there and totally brought into the mix. And so it was – nobody was without anybody.
They are, quote-unquote, a family.
Oh, yeah, they are. They're brothers and sisters when they come back. Now, they're brothers because they're with the unit there, and the girls are with their own units, and I'm sure they're, like, family too. But I got to see the young men, and they were absolutely like brothers, really, really close by the time it was done.
Well, be proud.
Yeah, I'm happy for
him. Be proud.
I'm really happy that he got that experience. You know, I've had some people say to me afterwards, aren't you scared? You know, yeah, I'm scared. I mean, everybody's going to be scared when, you know, your kid goes into the service because you don't know what's going to happen. But there's also things that can happen to them just,
they
know,
grow
living
up.
In the community. Hmm. And so, you know, it's a dangerous world for a young man or woman who, you know, is trying to find their way. So, I don't know. I almost feel like he's in a better place.
I think it's fabulous. I think I told Linda when I was in college, I had tried out for Angel Flight. Mm-hmm. And I would have loved to have served. Mm-hmm. I did get – I'm not proud of it. I made it to the very end, and then I didn't get accepted. But even back then, it was during the Vietnam War time. And I would have loved – to have been part of that.
Oh, you would have been good at that.
So hats off to Coleman and to all the others that
served. There were a lot of women serving. I was surprised at the amount of troops that were women. And the whole thing, it was an eye-opener for me. I thought I was going to be one of the only families. Because when my husband was in the Air Force, and when he went, there weren't a lot of family members there at graduation. So that's a change. Mm-hmm. My brothers were in the Air Force. I mean, I have a lot of Air Force people in my family. But they same thing. People just didn't really go down. They had a day where they all got to go out together. They got a liberty, you know, a town liberty. But this, something's changed in the whole thing because now families are very involved. Everybody's down there. So very impressed. I mean, you should be, everybody should
kudos
be impressed
to Coleman.
And thankful for the quality exactly. of the military.
They're the best.
They are. You can see why we are they a formidable are. Group. Now, let's see, Easter came, so I had an Easter celebration too. What did you do the week before? Because I haven't seen you.
That was that really boring week.
The weekend before?
That I said I might have to lie.
Have you seen
and
any
again,
movies?
I thank God for Easter.
Have you seen any movies?
No, I haven't. You know, I did follow the Final Four, Kentucky versus Wisconsin. And, I mean, what a game. What a game being Kentucky was favored to win March Madness and, what, be the first team in decades to do it with an undefeated record.
Didn't happen.
What a great game.
Yeah, it was. And, of course, tonight is the final game. I've always predicted
with
Purdue's going to come out. I've always predicted, yeah. Duke. I always predicted Duke was going to come out. See, I'm so bad. I don't even follow enough basketball.
So you're following Duke.
I've always thought Duke was going to be the one that came out. On top.
And you have money on this. You're involved
in brackets.
Oh, I'm already out. Okay.
I mean, somebody, I can't even, yeah, I don't, I should never have gone into a bracket. But I did.
I want to do that next year. I do.
So I saw the movie Get Hard.
Now tell me, I know nothing about that. Nothing.
Well, I thought it was really funny. It was, there's parts that I was crying, I was laughing so hard I was crying. Just crying. I mean, tears coming down. But there were some parts I found very uncomfortable.
Now, tell
us
the
if you see it,
premise.
You'll know what I'm talking about.
Tell us the
premise. In
fact,
the whole audience did. There's some parts he just pushes it sometimes a little too much.
I know nothing of this movie, Linda.
Right. Oh, you don't even know the premise?
No.
Get Hard is, you know, Will Ferrell's character. He's going to be incarcerated because he's like a white-collar crime guy.
Okay.
And so he wants to learn because he's going to have to, he knows he's going to go to prison. He's been sentenced. And so he wants to get tough or get hard. You know, they play on that. And so that he can survive in prison.
Okay.
So he thinks that a black person, the guy who's taking care of his car, who's a comedian, I can't remember his name. I'll have to look it up real quick. But he thinks that he's going to.
Who is that?
Black,
it's not Chris Rock.
No, it's not Chris Rock. He thinks that he's already been to prison, surely. Kevin Hart.
Kevin Hart, okay.
And
no one's funnier.
So Kevin Hart, yeah, he's hilarious. So he's never been to prison in the show. You know, I'm sure he's never been to prison ever. But he, in the show, he's just a squeaky clean guy trying to start a business and everything. And so he decides, well, you know, for money, I'll do anything. And so he's willing to pay him $30,000 to do this. That's how much he needs to start his business. And so he decides to play along with it. And so basically it's like basic training for prison. So you can imagine the things that go on to get ready for prison. There's a lot of sexual stuff, you know, and that's the stuff that I can take sexual humor. But Will Ferrell always pushes it a little
he does.
Too far.
He
just
does.
To make you really uncomfortable.
And then Kevin Hart. I mean, you've got a
well,
real
Kevin Hart
there.
Didn't do it, but Will Ferrell pushed it. And but anyway, still there. I thought it was really funny. There were some parts that, like I said, had me crying. Just that whole
from
playing
laughter.
Between the two of them. Yeah, it was
I have to go see it then.
It was interesting. And then I thought it drug out a little bit at the end. Got a little bit slow.
You know, I love both actors, though, and I love
you.
Comedy. You know, we've talked about that. I love comedy.
I love comedy, too. I just wish, you know, used
to
there
chance.
Was. And quite honestly, the first part of that movie was so funny. He didn't need to throw in the
they don't
body,
need to.
You know.
I don't know what transpired, but they don't need to.
Right. Well, he's getting ready for prison.
Okay.
And, you know, the rape jokes and everything.
Right.
So that's what it's all
okay.
about.
Okay. Okay.
And he just took it, I think,
too
far.
Too far.
Too much. You know, it's like, we get it. You don't have to. But anyway, whatever. Will Ferrell does push it. He pushes the limits with his humor. I just wish that people would keep it to, they can have a lot of fun and really funny comedy without having to go there.
Exactly.
But anyway, well, let's go ahead and talk about our shows next. We're going to play some of the clips from the shows and that we've done. And we're also going to just give our thoughts. First of all, this has been a year. Now, I was doing this show or a show and different kinds of shows for, 3, 4, 5 years. I guess I started 2011? End of 2011. It's 2015. It's really going by fast. But, you know, you started last year with me with Resonandi.
I mean, what an honor.
What are your thoughts about
my thoughts this whole thing? Are what an absolute honor at this time in my life. Linda has run two successful podcasts. One is Minstrel and Muse, and she brings in top-notch musical people and artisans, and then she does an international wine tour, of which I learn from both of them. But when Linda asked me to be her co-host, I mean, what an honor, not only as a friend, a longtime friend, a couple's friend, but to see you once or twice a year, or year, a week. I have learned so much, and as anybody, if you listen to me, you can tell Linda is very smart and very professional, but you listen to me, and I'm not. I am what I am. But I have learned I have learned so much by trial and error, timing. And Linda knows my biggest problem, or one of my major problems, is silence. I have a real problem with moments of silence. And has tried to teach me timing. And silence is okay. And so, I mean, I have been so honored. I look forward. The people that we've had on the show with Linda, we do a show that hopefully we bring in good people. Good people. It has to be a good show or we don't do it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's shown by the people that we have on the show. Now, Linda speaks for herself. I'm a newbie, but I have been so honored. I do have to tell this one story with her baby, George Thorogood, the big jazz man.
And that's who we're going to play first.
And I do have to say something. I probably should wait, but I was speechless. And Linda would keep showing a card, talk, talk. I could not talk. And Linda is.
She put a picture of
George Thorogood in the chair across from me, thinking that she knows that if George was here, maybe I could talk with him. Uh-huh. But being that he's not here, I had a horrible time. Horrible time. She kept talking. I thought, I cannot talk. Linda is very brilliant, and
okay,
she knows.
That's enough.
Okay.
But the George Thorogood thing's funny because I did have this picture taped to the chair across from
I
Janie.
I died.
And I said, just pretend like he's in the room and you're talking
I
to
couldn't.
Him. And
nothing came out. Nothing came out.
Well, that's
out.
A good introduction to this clip. We're going to go ahead and play you a little bit of that show, not all of it. These are still available in archives, and you can click on them and listen to the whole thing anytime you want. And then we're going to be back, and we're going to talk about our thoughts with some other of our guests.
We'll do it.
On the day I was born, the nurses gathered round and gazed in wide wonder at the joy they had found.
Hey, Andy and I are here today with legendary rock and bluesman Mr. George Thorogood of George Thorogood and the Destroyers. They're currently traveling around the U.S. on their 40 Years Strong tour, and they'll be stopping by to rock us here in little old Spokane on September 21st. Tickets are on sale now, so you better grab them. And thanks for joining us, Mr. Thorogood.
Hey, what's the story on Bigfoot? Any sightings?
We saw him today, this morning, yes. Had coffee with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been up there since 79. I've yet to see any Bigfoot.
We will have him ready for you.
Yeah, well, at least they will have some stories about him.
Very reclusive creature.
That's right. Well, where are you right now? Are you anywhere near Washington State?
We swore an oath with the government not to give the whereabouts of our location.
Oh, well, that's going to be hard for concert goers to find you then.
Well, I'll get there. I'll find you. How's that?
Yeah.
There you go.
And you're going to be here September 21st. We still have a couple months, and I was announced pretty late, but we're super excited about it. You're my generation. Your songs influenced my life, so really excited to see you.
Well, Northwest is one of our favorite places to go. The weather's beautiful up there, especially that time of year. Really, really, only had nothing but pleasant experiences, and in Oregon and Washington. The whole state really was beautiful. The West Coast of we did a gig in Seattle once on the right on the dock of the bay with Booker T and EMGs.
Sweet.
It was that.
Congratulate you on 40 years together with your band. That's huge. That's longer than most marriages. So I have to ask you, how did you do it?
Well, I guess it boils down to you're getting paid well to do something you really enjoy doing, and doing it for people who really enjoy what it is you do. The demand has just been stronger as years go on, or else you wouldn't still be doing it.
People don't want it, you're not going to be giving anymore. If they don't show up and they're not excited about it, you're going to quit.
Yeah, well, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the three things, the desire rules everything. It's the desire, the demand, and the delivery. Are we delivering? And are we enjoying it while we're doing it? Mm. And also, you know, we have to pay taxes too, you know. We have to eat, you know? So the demand has to be there. You know, so if one of those three things are all in line, we'll keep going as well as our health, our energy will allow us.
One of your concerts look like? Do you make the songs new every night? Is it a different experience depending on which concert you're at?
It's a different experience every night because it's a different audience every night. So you got probably 50% of the people, 60% never heard us before. So that's a new experience for both us and the audience. Keeps it fresh.
She ain't gonna get none of it. So I stop at a local bar, you know people. I go to the bar, I rent my coat, I call the bartender, said, look man, come down here. He got down there, said, what you want? One bourbon, one scotch, one beer. Well, I ain't seen my baby since, I don't know when. I've been drinking bourbon, whiskey, scotch, and gin.
Do you tour with anybody else anymore, or are you guys just by yourself?
We have various acts work with us pretty much on a daily basis. We've done tours where we just us and Steve Miller or Buddy Guy and us. But usually it's a different band almost every night.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to step back just a little bit because I'm a big fan of Muddy Waters. And, you know, I listened to a lot of interviews before, you know, as soon as I heard it, it's going to be talking to you. And you said in one of them that you wrote Bad to the Bone with Muddy Waters in mind.
Well, when I completed it, yes, I said that this is a song that'll be right up his alley. The blues slide guitar and a very tongue-in-cheek macho lyrics and all that bull.
On the day I was born, the nurses gathered round and gazed in wide wonder at the joy they'd found.
She could tell right away.
We didn't know what it meant or anything. We just loved it. But I was listening to it again these last. I'm a little older now. I was listening to it these last couple days, and I'm like, wow, that's pretty gutsy.
Oh, well, I was a fan of those kind of lyrics before, you know, like Ramblin' Gamblin' Man by Bob Seger and Who Do You Love by Bo Diddley and 300 Pounds of Joy by Howling Wolf. And, you know, I just got a kick out of it. It's like a song of a total fantasy, you know, like a James Bond movie.
Mm-hmm. That would qualify. Now, Muddy Waters, you opened for him, too. Do you have any memories of him?
All good ones.
All good ones, I bet.
That's nice.
Yep.
Did you ever get to jam with him? Like, you know, I saw yeah. YouTube with...
One time. He invited me up to play with him. Yeah, one song.
One song.
I played too loud.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
I walk 47 miles of barbed wire. I got a cobra snake for a necktie. A brand new house along the roadside, and it's made out of rattlesnake hide. Got a brand new gin that baby put on top, and it's made out of human skull. Come on, take a little walk with me, baby, and tell me who do you love? Who do you love? Now around the town, he was a rattlesnake whip. Take it easy, baby, don't you give me no lip.
Inspirations then? Was he one of them?
I listened to his music, but I had a lot of people that were that I was really laid into heavy, like Robert Johnson, Elmore James, Howling Wolf, a lot of Jimmy Reed, listened to that a lot, as far as blues people go. But yeah, I listened to Muddy Waters, but I was much more of a Howling Wolf man. You know, you check it out in the archives. You should listen to Howling Wolf play Mississippi Delta slide guitar, electric or acoustic, as good as anybody. He was as good as Muddy Waters, maybe better. He just didn't do it on stage that often. But he was really good at it.
Oh, I bet he was. I bet he was.
Howling Wolf.
Took a map by my hand. She said, Lonesome George, you don't understand. Who do you love? The night was dark and the sky was blue. Down the aisle where I swag and flew. Hit a bump and somebody scream. You should have heard just what I seen. Who do you love? Who do you love? Yeah, who do you love?
Now, you had a lot of influence, influences. I read that you did another song, I Drink Alone, with George Jones in mind.
I drink alone. Yeah, with nobody else. I drink alone. Yeah, with nobody else. Yeah, you know when I drink alone, I prefer to be by myself.
Well, I was trying to make a country song out of it. I thought it'd be a, you know, a good tune for him, you know, because, you know, he had a reputation for that sort of thing at the time. And it was a comedy song. It still is a comedy song.
I mean, he just passed last year. That was a sad day.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. See you in 2 months. Keep an eye out for Bigfoot for me, will you?
We'll round him up.
Have him in a cage.
Okay.
All right. Good luck tonight.
George, thank you.
She could tell right away. I was bad to the bone. Bad to the bone.
All right, so that was, the interview with George Thorogood on his 40 Year Strong Tour.
Good memories.
So bring back memories, yeah. I went to that concert. You didn't make it, right?
No.
I went to that concert with my family, my husband and my sons. This before my son went to boot camp, and then I've got another son who is extremely musical, and you know, he records and plays, and so he loved it. He was just George. He knew right who George Thorogood was,
so incredible.
And he was right there to go with us. Oh, it was a fantastic concert.
So incredible.
And it was packed out. I mean, it was really, he just, you know, he's not young anymore. He's not old either. He's not like some, but like the Rolling Stones or anything. But he can still play that guitar.
I bet.
And sing. He puts on a great, great performance. And he's a businessman. That came out clear in that interview.
Oh, yeah. He calls it like he sees it.
Yeah. Like he's going to, he does it for money. You know, he has to leave his family and go tour. And, you know, as long as people are coming and wanting to hear it, he'll come, he'll play it. So what did you learn through that interview?
You know, I sat there, silent, uh-huh. And hear talk. What I learned from that, I mean, it was a strong interview.
Yeah.
And you handled it really, really well. I mean, what a great guy. But, I mean, he calls it like he sees it.
Right. Well, some of these interviews, you don't know.
Yeah.
You're not best friends with them. You don't hang out with them. So when they do show up for an interview, you don't always know what you're going to get. We're going to find out. We have Felipe Rose on here in a little bit. You know, KC and the Sunshine Band, KC was on.
Oh, gosh.
And he was
They were great.
And you don't know who's showing up for that interview. Jeff Foxworthy. I mean, we get nervous before we start an interview because you don't know who – how they're going to...
Well, you teach me.
There's
you
the public
prep
persona.
Me, which is so nice. But,
I don't know either because you see their public persona and you have a little bit of time with their agents, but you don't know what they're going to be like when they get on that phone and we start to do the interview. And some of these guys and gals, you know, they're pretty hard to approach.
You were good. George scared me. He did.
Well, that Bigfoot thing threw
he
us off.
He did.
We weren't,
he scared me.
We weren't Bigfoot experts or anything, but we went with it.
He scared me.
So I want to go to another one. This is a very short clip, but this one brought back memories of last year, Malaysia Flight 370.
Right, and this is Steve Ball. And, you know, I have to give them a tremendous amount of credit. Linda has, again, done these shows forever. But when we started this Rez and Andy, the Balls have been there, Steve and Robin. Of course, Robin with Sharpshooting and
she had the gals, the gun girls
rights.
With guns on,
yeah.
The girls with guns on campus were a big thing.
She knows her stuff. And Steve, of course, being
a pilot
and serving.
So he was answering questions
he
about
knows
Malaysia.
Stuff.
Malaysia 370. Malaysia 370 went down last year. You know, and since then we had this pilot suicide just recently. And now it brings that one even into question again. Was that a suicide? And we were asking him these questions like, what do you think based upon what we know right now? He had a hard time going one way or the other with it. So we didn't get – but he told us a lot about the way things – the way the search and rescues are conducted.
Well, he was right
on. Black box. And he was. And we don't have
the answers. Terrorist. He was right on.
Yeah, he was right about that. The suicide, he wasn't willing to go there. He said there weren't a lot of suicides. And a lot of pilots I've seen, you know, interviewed since this most recent one are saying the same thing, that, you know, pilot suicides are so rare that we don't really need to change things too much, you know, other than what we already have in place. And they're afraid that if we make it too big a deal, then pilots who do need mental health help aren't going to go get it. So they're warning us that, you know, you got to be careful with this screening and the records from doctors and because don't blow it out of proportion. There's not that, and that's the same thing that Steve Ball was saying. It's rare. These are trained young men, you know, and women. They've got lots of hours of experience behind a plane. But it is starting to look more like that was a suicide, but we may never know because they haven't found the plane.
You know what I loved about Steve was he had a real pragmatic approach. It wasn't, and I love, I mean, it wasn't a media-driven approach.
No, he totally avoided the sensationalism that we
exactly.
tried to get him to go into. Because I had all kinds of conspiracy theories, and mm-hmm. I was throwing them out at him, and he was just like, no.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go ahead. This is a very small piece of it, just a minute and 29 seconds. I thought it was interesting.
Yay, Steve.
Because it falls along the line of profiling the pilots?
Well, let's get to the pilot then now. I think we've covered the plane itself for at this moment, but let's move towards the pilot. They had a flight simulator. It's a pretty big flight simulator. And he had also erased a lot of the data on the flight simulator, which the FBI is now involved in retrieving. And he had attended a Malaysian opposition meeting before the flight. I don't know exactly what the time frame was there, but sometime before this flight, where one of the members there was arrested. Now, before we started this, you said that the chance of a pilot turning against his and going bad is 0.00 something. But what do you think about this pilot with that information?
I know absolutely nothing about him other than I said he had 18,000 hours of flight time, which is a lot of flight time. And the fact that he had a simulator in his basement made me shake my head. He must be some kind of geek because pilots hate nothing more than the simulator. You want to fly the real airplane, the simulator is a total pain in the ass. You have to do it once a year. It's agony. That's why I should have flown 5 more years when I hit 60. I did not want to go through one more recurrent training session in the simulator for anything. So I quit the first day I could.
So you hate simulators. So that right there is very suspicious as far as you're concerned.
that being said, there are some geeks who like simulators.
So that was a very small piece of it, but it is still available in archives if you want to go back and, you know, kind of relive that and see what we came up with and some of the things we were thinking at the time. But like I said, you know, they haven't retrieved it. So we still don't know. We can pretty much guess anything. Nothing's been proven or disproven at this point. But it is looking more as if the pilot did it.
Right.
You know, he set the autopilot to a different course and it turned around and, you know, and got lost in the ocean. But the fact is that, you know, they may never recover it. So that was an interesting one.
That was really interesting.
You know, recently we've done, we did the Outlander. You know, Outlander's back on. We had the Outlander, the Huygens-Huligans.
Big following.
And the Outlander author, Diana Gabaldon.
It's her baby.
We did Monica Bellucci, the next Bond girl. And they're starting to release trailers for the next Bond movie, Spectre. And then we did this big one on women's roller derby. I mean, these gals are tough as nails. Something I was always interested in. Show to do. They were great. They're the kind of people who tell it like it is. They weren't scared of anything. Like I said, we did Casey and the Sunshine Band and the Village People. We did Time to Laugh author Deanna Davis, and we also had some comedians on that one. We did the Westminster Dog Show. We always do the Oscars every year. We do a run up to the Oscars on the show. We did Ron Grant. Let's see, Michael O'Neill is a great musician. The Lesbian Vampire Novels by Sherry Wohl. That's a friend of yours,
That's
right?
That's one of our, mm-hmm. our gals, yeah, who's involved with search and rescue with the dogs. And that's how I met her.
And that was another one we did. We did the
Oso.
The Oso mudslide.
I think that was one of my favorite interviews because you forget the commitment and the partnership between these dogs and these handlers.
Right, right.
That was a big one.
I love the comedians. I love having the comedians on. Paula Poundstone.
They're the best.
We should go ahead and play the Paula Poundstone one next because you and I went to her.
We had so much fun.
After the conversation, when she got into town, we went to her stand-up.
No one's better.
That's another time I laughed till I cried. You know, crying is so cathartic. It's like, you know, crying, laughing. I guess they're so closely related.
They are.
I think Deanna Davis told us that in that interview. But they do the same thing for the body. They really relieve stress.
Exactly.
I'd rather laugh than cry, but that Paula Poundstone one, remember how hard we laughed?
She was wonderful.
About peed my pants.
Wonderful.
She was so funny. Let's go ahead and listen to her here. She was funny in the interview as well. Paula Poundstone. Talk about. Today we have with us the hilarious Paula Poundstone. She's a comedian, author, the first woman to perform stand-up at the prestigious White House Correspondents' Dinner, and currently a regular panelist on the NPR News quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. For most of us, she's a cultural icon, and she's touring the country now performing shows from New York to Nevada. She'll be here in Spokane May 8th, but we have her today by phone. Thanks for joining us, Paula.
Thanks for having me.
So where are you at exactly?
I'm sitting on the floor of my bedroom in Santa Monica, California, with a large German Shepherd mixed dog beside me.
Okay. Well, what about your 16 cats?
They are, I don't allow them in my bedroom because they're very destructive. So they are, they're scattered about the living room. Yesterday was like the first really hot day of the year. And, yeah, so they're just draped over everything.
16 cats.
Cats are good. Cats are good.
People accuse me of being a crazy cat woman. I am not, because I also have two German Shepherd mixed dogs. If I had, just 16 cats, certainly I would be a crazy cat woman. But when you have 16 cats and two German Shepherd mixed dogs, you are an animal lover.
Paula, yeah. I would high five you.
Yeah, Andy over there has quite a few cats,
too. I have
too.
A She's lot got, of animals, yeah. So high no, five you. I do.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
all I
do
is clean. It's whenever anybody comes up and they go, oh, I have five cats, I go, stop right there.
They keep you honest.
Yeah. It's not as glamorous as it might sound.
No, not quite. Well, so are you on, you're on tour. Is this a break in your tour to be back home?
I'm on a relentless tour. It's not a tour like on the back of a sweatshirt. It's a lifetime tour. I go out pretty much every weekend. Usually it's, generally speaking, it's Friday, Saturday, and then there's the occasional Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then every now and then I'm not out at all, but generally speaking, it's two nights a week, which is longer than one might think.
Oh, yeah. Well, coming to Spokane, I mean, you're coming out into the boonies to come here. You're really coming off the beaten path.
We're very excited to have you, Paula.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. You know, I've been there a couple times before. There's electricity. It's not that far away.
We're not all bad.
No, it wasn't my sense at all. I went to a Occupy Spokane event.
Oh yeah, about 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, it was a while back, and I was struck by how kind everyone was. We were on the river, I guess, on like a little. There was like a little, I don't know what you call it. It was a little bridge going out into the river, and then this little, I don't know.
The gondolas?
It was where they, there was like some stairs and people. I got the sense that it's some sort of performing area on a regular basis. I don't know what it was called. Someone drove me there. You walked out onto this little bridge, and then there was like a platform there from which they were performing. And so I sort of ran out onto the little, the little bridge onto the platform. And when I came back, someone had my phone in their hand. And I'm like, what? They said, this is your phone. I'm like, why do you have my phone? And they said, well, it fell in the water when you ran across the bridge. And then I realized the person I'm talking to is all wet. And she had jumped in the water she rescued my phone. It was
and then you put it in a bowl of rice.
And that's such a Spokane thing to say, because people started saying to me, well, you put it in rice. Like this is something that everyone knows. Yeah, of course you put it in rice. You're going to put it in rice, aren't you? I'm on the road. I don't have rice. Well, I'm telling you, a few minutes later, someone ran to the store and got me rice.
Hey, Paula.
Had a delicious bowl of phone-cooked rice that night.
Hey, Paula, you are so fabulous. One of the real things that stick out with me when I see your performance is you just have such a great rapport with your audience, and you work off the cuff and you ad lib. And I think one of the funniest routines I've seen you do was the Lubrak routine.
Well, it's not exactly a routine. I was talking, it was an HBO special years ago.
Right.
I taped it in San Francisco, and I was talking to the audience. And so I guess I asked somebody what they did for a living, and they said they were a lawyer. And when the person said they were a lawyer, somebody on the other side of the room went like, oh. And so then I turned to that person. I said, well, have you had a bad experience with lawyers? And it turned out, and I really pressured the woman to explain why she had this reaction. And then she said that her mother had her face ripped off on a Lubrak.
It was unbelievable.
Well, it wasn't what I expected. There was something about it. I don't know, maybe it was the timing of the woman saying it or what. It was so not what I expected. And the little known backstory to the whole HBO special, this was when I I got the job from HBO to do this hour special, you know. They said, well, you can't talk to the audience. You have to just do like a scripted routine. You can't talk to the audience. And I was like, well, that's ridiculous. Why? Why would you hire me if I couldn't do that? Because that's kind of the life's blood of the whole thing.
Yeah, that's what your thing, and, that's your thing is.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of made no sense. I mean, it's not that I couldn't do that, but it seemed a bit flavorless. So I argued and argued with them about it. And I'm not a big arguer as a general rule, but I felt strongly about this. So, and the thing is, it was a long time ago. The technology was different. Probably now it'll be a lot easier to do. But back then, so the only rehearsal, because I don't rehearse what I do, but the only rehearsal that I had for this was that that day, or perhaps the day before, I don't recall anymore, we had the theater, and this is before any audience members were in there, we had production assistants sit in different seats in the theater, and I would pretend that they were audience members for a few seconds so that we could see if the audio people could pick up what we were doing.
Okay.
So we mic'd the audience, and then we had a guy with a what do they call it, a fish mic, a guy with a long mic on a pole just beat feet across the theater to whoever I was talking to and get that mic over near them. And then the HBO people, like the directors and stuff like that, they're all in a truck. They're not in the room with me. They're like in a truck watching on these monitors out in the parking lot somewhere. So here I had done all this preparation and all this arguing to get them to allow me to talk to audience members. And now one of the first people I talked to says to me, you know, after I pressured her to tell me why she didn't like lawyers, she goes, well, my mother ripped her face off on a lube rack. And I was just horrified.
It was incredible. It was
oh, my
incredible.
God, they're going to kill me. Because it seemed like rather a downer for a comedy show.
You could have paid
somehow,
someone and not
right,
had a better answer.
But there was something about it that was really funny. And to this day, I don't really know why, because it's not inherently funny for your mother to have her face ripped off on a lube rack unless you really don't like your mother or her face was objectionable in the beginning.
But well, you just engage the audience so much, Paula.
Which makes me wonder, are people afraid to sit in the front seats of your shows?
I don't think so. I don't. They don't
the weaver,
look afraid.
The printer, yeah.
Well, the thing is, I talk to people all over. It's true that I might talk to people in the front maybe more, but I talk to people throughout the crowd. So, a lot of times I'll talk to somebody and say, hey, what do you do for a living? They might be, several rows in or toward, and they go, we didn't sit up front. Like, that they thought they had planned so carefully, and now here I was talking to them. I'm not mean to people or anything. I it's just a conversation. I don't draw them out to be rude
right.
to them or torment
but
them.
But you
or
just come up with these things so fast. How did you ever get like that? I mean, it's just whatever comes to your mind, it comes out, and it's always funny. Is it just practice or?
It is kind of practice. It's more deciding that that's an okay thing to do. When I first, because the truth is, every conversation we have is unscripted, and no one talks to somebody else and goes, whoa, that was amazing. How did you do that?
Right.
When I first started out doing open mic nights in Boston, I started in 1979. And at that time, the sort of open mic scene was huge. A lot of audience members came to, I think people had this feeling that they were getting in on the ground floor of something, and it was very exciting. And there would be a huge lineup of people. Excuse me. The premise was that anybody who wanted to could sign up on the list and go up and do, their version of stand-up comedy for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And the list would be very, very, very long. And so people were really touchy about the five-minute thing. If you went over, the people waiting to go on had pitchforks. So,
really? I'm sure.
Yeah, they were really, because the other thing is the guys that were later on the list, well, actually I was usually the later on the list person, but people were, sort of further down the list, everybody went over. Now it's like, you could have waited there until 1:30 in the morning and you don't get on because the club closed or the audience left. So people got really touchy about this time thing. So I would write out 5 minutes of material. I would type it up on the back of, I used to bus tables at a restaurant in Boston, and their menus were on their placemats, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so when the prices would change, the placemats were sort of obsolete. And so I used this is like long before the recycle reuse mentality, but I would use the back of those menus to type on. And so I'd have my 5 minutes typed out on the back of a menu, and I would memorize it during the week. The whole time I was bussing tables, my lips would be moving because I was memorizing my 5 minutes. And then when on the big night, the big open mic night, I would walk onto stage, and pretty much the moment I hit the stage, I would either panic and forget what I was going to say, or something struck me that I saw on the way up, and I would sort of inadvertently blurt it out, and then I'd realize, well, now I have no idea where I am in this 5 minutes. And so I would be sort of forced to tread water by talking to audience members or talking about what I saw on the way up or whatever. And every time I'd come off, and of course people would be pissed because I'd go over my five, and then I'd be like, oh, this is like horribly unprofessional. It's a really bad thing to allow my mind to go anywhere but these 5 minutes. I don't remember what day I finally went, oh, you know what? This is the good part.
That's the funny part. Yeah.
This is like the joy of the entire thing.
Yeah.
And then I also happen to have the...
And that show went on. It was much longer, but that she was so fun.
She was wonderful. She's as down to earth as they come.
And when we went, we sat in, what, the fourth maybe?
Yeah, we were right up there.
We were close enough. We didn't get called on. But the guy in front of us, remember, he said, she asked where he's from, and he's from Nebraska. And then she asked what he did, and he said he was in the Navy. And she's like, I didn't realize they have... a Navy in Nebraska. And that was the butt of the joke for the rest
quick.
Of the night.
She is quick.
It was very funny. But it's just one of those things. It's almost like inside humor because you have to be there and you see the response of the audience member. And, yeah, she was really quick.
I would go see her in a heartbeat
again. People had driven all the way from Seattle to see her that night.
Exactly.
We talked to them after the show, and they didn't mind at all being, singled out like that. They loved it. And it was one of the highlights of the show.
They rolled with it.
And a lot of her material I'd already heard, but she didn't do that same material on that night. It was new. But even though I had seen and listened to the CDs and seen the stuff on YouTube and all that, she doesn't regurgitate the same
stuff.
No, she
doesn't.
It's always new. So that was a fantastic, fantastic
She's
experience.
She's a neat woman.
I'd see her any day. I would take time out of my day. I'd drive a long way to see her. She is worth every minute that you invest, money's not such a big time. It's her time that's so hard. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I think she is amazing.
So
I know. Talk. Where's George? Where's George when I need him?
We're going to say about time. But time is just, that's our biggest problem, is finding time to go to things.
Oh, man. Exactly. Exactly.
So let's take a look at some of these other ones we had. Health benefits of sleeping in the buff. That was good. We had that wildfire. It's huge here in Washington State. And there was an elderly lady who was caught in that. And we interviewed her, Campbell.
Carlton.
Cecilia. Is it Cecilia Campbell? And all these shows, we learned so much about things we didn't know jack about before.
Exactly.
And the marijuana, we did a big thing because it was legalized here in Washington State. So far, so good. Nothing's happened.
And we'll do a follow-up on that,
I would assume,
a year later.
I guess it's going to be our follow-up. There's nothing, or talk to the owners,
I don't think it's changed the world.
When it first came out, it was really expensive, but now it's cheap.
It is. I thought that was really an interesting conversation. Of course,
Lots of conversations.
It was Colorado and Washington State, and, we worked hard on that show.
Yeah, we interviewed a lot of people.
We did. Mm-hmm. And
people off the street, too.
I thought it was
one of those polarizing things with the population. There are people who are against it were really against
people
it.
People are very fearful of change, and, rightfully so. But mm-hmm. I thought the education that we brought about was really, really good on that show. I enjoyed that show.
Well, the marijuana shop owners personalized them. They were very much just regular business people.
They were very
smart business people.
One was from Microsoft or Amazon or one of those.
I think it was Microsoft.
Was it Microsoft? Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys are business people. They are smart people. So I thought it was very, very interesting. I enjoyed that show. I enjoyed doing the homework. And we worked hard on that for a week.
We did. Now, then there was the California Chrome interview with a jockey, a veteran jockey. And that was great. And it was really well listened to. California Chrome, remember last year?
Exactly.
We thought he might win the Triple Crown, but he didn't. We still don't have a Triple Crown winner. But that was a great show.
Well, it was neat. That was a good show listening from the perspective of a jockey. And I thought the neat deal about that show was Billy Vance had mentioned the fact that, you know, it's not the jockey that's the athlete, it's the horse. And Linda really zoomed in on this one comment was the fact if they're attuned to winning, they're like any athlete, they will want to win. If they're attuned to losing, they will fall back.
Yeah,
and I thought that was a real interesting comment.
Once a horse starts to lose, it continues to
mentally
lose.
They will fall back.
The other thing he said was that a lot of times a horse actually does run better for a certain jockey. That is absolutely true.
I thought it was a good interview.
Yeah.
Really good.
So sometimes you put a jockey with a horse, it's a great connection. Sometimes the jockey and the horse just don't match up.
Exactly.
Let's go ahead and play another one of our interviews now. We'll go back to another musical interview. Felipe Rose from the Village People.
That was one of our favorite ones.
And that was the first interview you had with a professional.
It was. And what a character. In fact, we met with him and Rez and her husband, and I was lucky enough to find a date to go to watch.
Go see him in person.
Yeah, they were really fun.
And then you partied with them afterwards.
We connected with them afterwards and had a drink with them and his group, you know, the Village People at Northern Quest Casino. And what a character.
Yeah, well, it comes out in this. Let's go ahead and play it, and then we'll talk a little bit more about what happened that night. Here we go with the Felipe Rose from the Village People, and he's the original Native American. Our guest today is Felipe Rose, the original Native American in the Village People, the iconic American band that sold 100 million records and whose songs YMCA and Macho Man, to name only two, are still 37 years later some of our absolute favorites. Welcome to the show, Felipe.
Hello, hello. Good morning, everyone.
Welcome.
Yeah, I'm in
awake.
Voice.
That'll wake us up.
I'm awake.
Hey, Felipe.
Andy, hi.
Have you ever been to this area before?
I can't remember. I can't say if I have or haven't. I'm not good at stuff like that. I think Alex, the GI, and Eric are a biker. Mm-hmm. Who's been with us for 20 years. They're very good at remembering, like where we were, like, 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Once I do a show, I just walk away. I can't, you know, I don't, never,
well,
no, I don't know. I can't
Seattle.
Remember if I have.
We won't let
Is that
you
near
forget
Seattle?
Us.
Yeah, how about Seattle?
Okay, so we've been to Seattle.
Yeah.
We've been to Oregon, right?
Oh, I'm sure you've been to all those places,
That's another state.
Yeah.
So that's
Nevada.
That's Portland. So no, I've
Montana.
Not been there.
Oh, funny. Where are you right now?
I'm on the Jersey Shore in New Jersey.
Well, you're going to be
You've
a long way from
You've
home.
You've heard of Asbury
We have
Park.
Heard.
Oh yeah.
Many, many times. But we have to touch base on your mother, because reading on your background, your mother was a huge inspiration in your life. And, of course, you love to dance. But I have to make note here on your mother that she was a dancer for the Copacabana in the 40s
actually,
and 50s.
She was she left Puerto Rico when she was she left by boat. So we're going back in the 30s, in the late 1930s. And so she grew up in New York City and was raised in the public school system of New York City in Manhattan. And her mother, as many parents do in other countries, particular Mexico and in other countries, where the parents come first, then they send for their children just to build a better life. And that's what my grandmother did from Puerto Rico. So she left my mother with I think her sister that was a school teacher, and then when she was 7 years old, she was put on a boat on an ocean liner, and she came to the United States that way.
Wow. Well, she really,
and
again,
she grew up in New York, and she then met high school friends that were cutting class and going off to go dancing to the Copacabana because they had afternoon mambo and salsa lessons. And she just said, oh, I like this. And
that is really a neat story.
She quit high school, and she then became a dancer, and you know, she was a chorus girl, and she used to hang out with like movie stars and went down to Miami on weekends and on a boat to Cuba. And that was when in Cuba, the stories that she used to tell me of how elaborate and how beautiful the clubs were in Havana with Ernest Hemingway and that whole era, how beautiful it was, where people dressed to go out to impress.
So was it like growing up with a mom like that? Because you're a major dancer. I mean, the Village People, that's what
they
do.
Well, I'm not
a
major dancer. I think I started late in life dancing. I mean, to start dancing like well into like 16, 17, where today kids start at 3 and 4. That was late.
True.
The influence of musicians and singers and poets at the house, I had that growing up. And so I absorb, you know, it's a child will absorb whatever they're it's presented and what they grow up with. And so for that reason, I love that she, of course, was artistic in that sense.
You're very artistic. You not only dance and sing and everything else, but you also have your own art.
I paint. Thank you. I paint. I cook. I write. I'm a motivational speaker. I'm an ordained minister. That's a lot of fun.
Oh,
my gosh.
I read that.
And, in fact, the biker and I, we were ordained in Vegas by this couple that wanted to get married on 11-11-11 because that was like a big tricky – that was a big number where lots of weddings were happening. And so they ordained us, and then we married them on stage. They actually ordained us on 11-10-11, but then on 11-11-11, on the night of the show, they came up on stage in their disco in their disco outfits on.
That's awesome.
And we married Alberta and Frank Smokes, S-M-O-A-K-E-S. And then we became ordained ministers. And I'm batting 8 weddings to Eric's now 3,
okay.
I guess.
If I wasn't already married, I'd ask you to marry me in a heartbeat when you come here to Spokane. But
if I ever get married, I am calling you.
Andy, you have 1 month to find a guy.
We do a banging job. We do a banging job. But see, Eric is more in control of things than I am because when it comes to the part when...
Okay, so that was the Village People's Felipe Rose.
Oh, man.
That was fun.
He was unreal.
Yeah, you didn't find anybody to
get
married to in a month.
No, I'm still single. Where's Felipe when I need him?
That's right. Well, he'll marry you, but not find the person
for
you. I have
to find someone.
He needs to be his second career.
So funny.
But you had fun with him that
night. Oh, he's a great guy. He is what he is.
And the rest of the group, too. And some of KC's people, too, were down there with you, right?
They joined us, too. Yeah, it was just really nice. All down to earth, all fun loving. They were crazy. Yeah. They were so fun.
That's one of the fun things about doing the show. You meet a lot of people, and it's really nice when they do come to town and you can meet them in person as well. And, you know, they're just human beings doing their thing.
They are.
Their passions in life. Making, like, you know,
they're
George
like
Thurgood.
All of us.
They're businessmen. Yeah. So, yeah, that was a great one, too. You know, do you think you're more comfortable now talking to some of the people since you started a year ago?
You know, I'm getting there. I have a problem with the musicians because, you know, the musical world. I don't. I did play piano for 12 years, but you know the musical world very well. And so I sit back. You know, the one thing I've learned is, and it's hard for me, but if you don't know what you're doing, you sit back and you listen and you learn.
Oh, well, actually, that's what we do most of the time anyway, is you sit back and
you know
listen.
Your stuff.
Yeah, all
you
of
know
us.
Your stuff.
All of us. People are, except for this show, which is all about us, usually the show we back off. We just have an introduction, you know, and if you want to skip past that, just go 10 minutes in and then you can skip us entirely. But for the most part, we just step back and let whoever's here tell their story. And that's what we're always trying to do.
Right.
Get out of their way. So we have another comedian I want to get to, Jeff Foxworthy, because he was coming to town.
What a good guy.
And he, I was nervous about talking to him, too, because, you know, biggest all-time selling comedian. But he was such a Southern gentleman, so down to earth, so nice. Let's go ahead and play piece of that. These are all longer interviews, too, like I said. So you can go in the archives and listen to more if you want. Andy and I are here today with the hilarious Jeff Foxworthy. He has the great honor of having helped more people laugh than anyone on earth as the largest selling comedy recording artist of all time. He's garnered multiple Grammy Award nominations for those albums, authored several best-selling books, and starred in five popular television programs. He's also part of one of the most successful comedy tours of all time, the Blue Collar Comedy Tour. He's going to be here in Spokane September 12th, and we're so happy to have him with us. Thanks for stopping by, Jeff.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And you're back there in Atlanta, Georgia today.
I am. This is home. It has been for probably about the last 15 years. I grew up here and spent about 7 or 8 years in L.A. And when NBC invited us not to return for the fall schedule with the sitcom, I just kind of thought that, you know, I want my kids to grow up around their family. So I live next door to my brother, and he's got three daughters, and I've got two. And so life is good here.
Could that be said to be the redneck capital of the world now that you're there?
Well, wherever I am, they've moved up in the rankings. I can tell you that for a fact.
That's right. Well, I remember your comedy very well when you first came into the scene. I was a teenager, and my family, I think we always considered ourselves rednecks, and you helped us laugh at ourselves. You actually gave us a framework to laugh at ourselves. Thank you for that, by the way.
Well, you know, and I think that's why it worked, is it was never laughing at somebody, because honestly, people say, how do you come up with that? And I'm like, there's no research going on. This is my family and friends. But what I found out growing up in the South, I kind of thought we had exclusive rights to rednecks. And one of the coolest things about doing stand-up is I've been to all 50 states, been to just about every part of all 50 states. And I've realized once you get 20 minutes outside of any big city, people are the same, and there were rednecks everywhere. So I think that's why that part of it was so successful. If it wasn't you, it was somebody related to you.
That's right. Well, we'll have quite a few of us rednecks ready for you when you come to Spokane, by the way.
Good. I will feel right at home then.
Okay, Jeff, I'm going to ask you. This is Andy here, and I stopped by our local comedy club. It's the Blue Door Improv. And by the way, it's volunteer-based, nonprofit, just great people. And after talking to a couple of the volunteers last night, they did have questions for you. Would you take those? I have two questions.
I would be delighted to.
Okay. Nick wanted to know, how did you get your start in comedy? And is there any room for you to grow as a comedian now that you've already gone as far as anyone can go?
Yeah, you're done, Jeff. You've gone as far as anyone can go.
It's time to
you're
get
retiring.
Out of the pool now.
You're retiring.
Golly, I hope not. The way I got my start, as a kid, I would save my allowance and I would buy comedy records. You know, it was Bill Cosby and Flip Wilson and Bob Newhart, and I would memorize them and I would go to school and do them and always get in trouble for making everybody laugh in school. And in fact, the best note I ever got backstage, I was playing the Fox Theater for the first time in Atlanta, and somebody brought a note to the dressing room, and it was from my high school principal. And the note said, I cannot believe I am shelling out money to listen to the same kind of stuff I used to try to put a stop to. Because I was in his office a few times with him just looking at me going, what do you think you are, a comedian? And, you know, apparently so, Mr. Gibbons, it's on the sign. But, you know, doing that as a child, I guess I never thought that was actually a viable career option. And so, like a lot of people, I got out of college. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I went and did what my dad did. My dad worked at IBM. And so I got a job there carrying a tool bag and fixing machines. It sounds glamorous, IBM, but it was a good job. And I was the guy at work that was always doing impersonations of the boss in the break room and always getting caught doing it. And a bunch of guys I worked with entered me in a comedy competition. And I said, oh, my gosh, I've never been to a comedy club. And so I went and watched 1 week, and I went home and wrote material about my family. And I went back the next week, and the first night I was on stage, I won the competition.
Wow.
And met my wife that night, who was at the club.
Wow.
So you talk about a life-changing night.
Yeah.
To meet your occupation and your wife of 30 years on the same night, that was a good night.
It was a bonus night.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, that was
so, you know, and she was there actually rooting for somebody else. She used to act back in those days, and she had done something with a guy that was a comedian. So a group of actors had come to root for this guy, and I beat him. And in those early days, when I started thinking about quitting that job at IBM, she was the only one that was saying, "You can do this. You can do this. I know you can do this." And you know, I think when I left IBM in 84, I was making $32,000 a year. And not long ago, I found the little calendar book for my first year of doing comedy, and I did 406 shows, and I made $8,300.
Mm.
And she, you know, so she wasn't in it for the money. I can tell you that in the early days.
Amazing story.
That $32,000 was a lot of money back then.
Well, it was, you know, and you had medical and dental insurance and wore a suit and tie. I remember when I decided to quit, my mother had one of those serious conversations at the kitchen table where she looked at me and she said, "Are you on the dope? Have you lost your mind?"
On the dope.
On the dope. And I said, "No, ma'am." I said, I think I can do this. I want to try this." And 5 years later, I was on Johnny Carson, and the same mother is looking at me going, "You know, you wasted all those years at IBM." And I'm like, okay,
amnesia.
Whatever. Yeah.
And you weren't on the dope.
That's a mother's prerogative.
And I wasn't on the dope. No, I wasn't.
I love it.
All right, what's your next question?
Okay,
from the
second
improv
question, yeah. Jeff, is Aaron has a question for you. And he wanted to know how your comedy has changed as you've aged.
So you haven't aged.
You haven't aged, and your family has grown up. Has it changed you as a comedian?
I've always considered myself one of the lucky comedians because I discovered early on what worked for me. Because in those early days of amateur nights, I can remember sitting around going, "What's funny? What can I talk about? What's funny? What's funny?" And I finally got to the point, because I think almost everybody has the thoughts comedians have, but I think they don't grab them. And that's so with me, I just decided, hey, if I think it, or my wife says it, or my kids do it, surely we're not the only ones. And so I just kind of trusted that. And that's where you get that laugh, you know, where people laugh and then they elbow the person next to them. Or, you know, the biggest compliment I get after a show is people coming up and going, "Oh, my God, you've been in our house." Because you're taking something that they do every day and they haven't thought about it being funny. You know, we all like to think we're unique, and yet we're not. And so if you go back and look at, I don't know, I've done 7 or 8 albums and 2 HBO specials and 2 Showtime specials and 3 blue-collar movies and 35 Tonight shows. All of it is a snapshot of what was going on in my life at that time. You know, in the beginning it was talking about being single, then it was talking about being a newlywed, then an expectant father, then a new father, and so... So from that standpoint, I don't think it's really changed. I mean, the things I talk about have, but I'm still just talking about my life. You know, now it's talking about things like colonoscopies and kidney stones, you know.
Yeah. Frog butt.
Okay, so that was Jeff Foxworthy.
Yeah, frog butt. Yeah,
funny
exactly.
guy.
What a
and
great
such
guy.
A nice person. It was really, really an honor to have him on the show. We've had a fun year. Just all this in a
We've
year.
We've had a great year. It has been so wonderful.
Yes, it makes you wonder who we're going to talk to this
been
year.
It's so wonderful. We have a couple good shows lined up here. We're working on them.
You just never know who's going to fall in our
never
lap
know.
Either. So if they present themselves, we will be there.
You bet. You bet.
To tape a conversation. You learn a lot about people, that's for sure. And it actually is very inspiring for anybody who wants to
do something like that. Like Jeff Foxworthy, really all of them have the same kind of tale. They just at some point threw it in with their passion, threw it all in, and you know, maybe didn't make as much money, but when you're doing what you love to do, it pays off.
They went for it.
They went for it, yeah. Very inspiring, which is kind of what we do with our show. We love doing this, and so we go for it. We don't care if we make money doing it or anything else. Well, the money would be nice.
It would be nice. Does anybody hear that?
Yeah, we don't care. We do this because we love to do it. We love to talk to people. We love to get together and talk to each other, and so that's why we are here, and hopefully it's entertaining for people who listen. So the last one we have a clip for, and this is just, you know, again, I just picked six of many that we did, and they're all available in archives, but is a Natasha Burton, and it was about sleeping naked, which mm-hmm. we found to be an interesting topic.
It was.
And the health benefits, it's funny because now at every cocktail party, this is great cocktail party talk. You know, I was trying to think, what's a small talk? This is great small talk, and I bring it up all the time. I don't know if it's appropriate or not, but I'm constantly talking about the health benefits of sleeping naked when I go.
It was hilarious. This gal is hilarious.
Yeah. And I don't know, I'll find anything. I can segue it from any conversation. We talk about the education system, and somehow I can turn that into, you know,
there
the
you
health
go.
Benefits of sleeping naked.
There you go.
So we'll go ahead and we'll listen to that, and we'll come back and give our last thoughts about our year with Rez and Andy.
So let's go down the list again. The next one would be sleeping better. You sleep better. Do you want to explain that one?
Yes. So I spoke with Lisa Shives, who sits on the National Sleep Foundation's board of directors. And she basically said that, you know, your body temperature is going to progressively decline while you sleep, which is just a natural tendency of the body. And if you're too warm, if you have, you know, heavy pajamas on and even heavy blankets, that can really disrupt that. So sleeping naked is a very easy way to keep your body cool. I believe I recently read something. I think your bedroom for optimal sleeping should be 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Or in that kind of range, mm-hmm. because that's what allows your body to really, you know, relax and get into that sleep cycle. Whereas if your bedroom's too hot, which I know personally I find this a lot, you know, you end up waking up in the middle of the night, kind of tossing and turning, you know, taking mm-hmm. your sheets off, putting them back on. So if you just don't wear any clothing, that's a really easy way to regulate your body temperature without, you know, having to deal with blankets and your thermostat and all that.
Especially when it gets really, really hot out like it is right now. That just seems like a given.
Yeah.
Okay, so then yeah. Three, it says you'll look hotter was the third one, I believe.
Yes. So I spoke with
everyone wants
naturopath.
To look hotter.
I mean, who doesn't, right? Mm-hmm. So naturopath Natasha Turner, she wrote The Hormone Diet, which is that, you know, best-selling book. She said that, you know, being too warm at night can really disrupt the release of melatonin and growth hormone, which are the hormones in your body that promote anti-aging. Her kind of take on it is that, you know, as your body temperature drops, this growth hormone is released and it works, you know, to regenerate your skin and your hair and all those, you know, all the things that keep you looking fabulous. So you want to make sure that you're not overheated at night so that you can, you know, allow your body to produce those hormones.
Wow. That's amazing. And then that kind of goes along with the fourth one is losing belly fat, which, you know, belly fat isn't hot. So
no, it's not.
Really interesting. Yeah. Really interesting.
And what's going on with the belly fat?
Well, this is one of the really unexpected things that I found. And, you know, if you sleep more soundly, you'll actually, your body will produce stress hormone cortisol. It will decrease the stress hormone cortisol as you rest, right? Which is what keeps your energy and your hunger levels kind of, you know, in balance. So if you don't get enough sleep, your cortisol will jump up. And it'll make you more likely to be hungry for, you know, kind of comfort foods when you wake up. It can cause you to overeat. So you really want to be able to get that sound sleep. I mean, it's really all about sound sleep, because if you can sleep well, you can do a lot of great things for your body, including, you know, the whole idea of cortisol and then also with the growth hormone. So if you're not getting a good night's sleep, I mean, you're kind of cheating yourself out of a lot of benefits.
And so the next one, feeling more confident, this is a little bit different. This is about feeling sexy, right? Like being naked and being more in tune to your skin and what your skin's feeling, and then that heightens awareness?
Yes. I mean, basically, like, you know, the sensation of your sheets and, you know, kind of feeling your body, like, in space without, you know, being inhibited by clothing really allows you to feel sexier, which can promote confidence and body acceptance. So it's just, it's just a good thing to do every now and then. If you're not comfortable with sleeping naked every night, at least try it once or twice a week, see how it goes, and kind of see if you can feel the effects.
Kind of ease into it.
Exactly, exactly. Or if you're ready, you know, just jump right in. So it's definitely good for you.
Okay, that was Natasha Burton, and that was some of the benefits of sleeping in the buff. It's interesting. She's preaching to the choir with me. We like it cold, cold, cold in our room. I mean, we actually reverse the fan and have the cold air blowing in, so even in the winter, so that it is way colder than 64 degrees in our bedroom.
Really?
Yeah.
I couldn't sleep
with
you.
So apparently I'm not aging at all.
I couldn't sleep with you. Has to be like 85 degrees.
I must have no cortisol, and I must look like I'm 18, as cold as I keep it. I think my face freezes and my bed freezes. We have those foam mattresses, and it actually freezes.
Really?
Yeah.
You're a little icicle.
We are. No, so I totally am. That's probably why I loved talking to her so much. I'm like, you know, just wanting to hear all these wonderful benefits that I'm getting. Yes, high fiver. Yes, exactly. I'm all about sleeping in the buff. So everybody should join in and do it. No, just kidding.
No, you're good. You've got it.
Yes, wild and free. So we're at the end of our show. We have lots more in the archives and lots more coming up. It's a fun thing to do. You know, it's so many different topics, so many different things to experience.
No, I want to thank everybody that gave us a shot. I mean, we're looking at Jeffrey Deaver, the big guy, 007, had no qualms about an interview with us. And Tommy Milner, CFO of Cabela's. We're looking at Mike Price, former WSU football coach, absolutely no question. Jack Lucas, Tony Higley, for taking a chance with us. Linda, you've done this. Anybody who knows you, it says all. But for our little show, nobody ever questioned us. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. It's been a fun time.
It's been a great year.
Thank you all for listening. We're going to go out now, but join us next Monday at 3 p.m. Also, like us on Facebook and Twitter and follow our show page. We appreciate all those follows. You guys have a great day.
Thank you.
Have a great year. Have a great life. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on Talk About with Rez and Andy, live every Monday at 3 p.m. Please join us next week for another great show. And please call in and share your thoughts and opinions. Also, look for us and like us on Facebook and Twitter, and follow our show page on BTR.